In a perfect world, we'd want government support and a lot more of it that would exist.
Now, why though?
The marketplace can't take care of everything. It's subject to the whims and the caprices of sponsors who want to change things. When you wake up at 3 a.m. and your house is on fire, you don't call the marketplace.
Let's talk a little bit about your broader kind of worldview. In a 1998 speech, you talked about why you were a yellow dog Democrat. What does that mean, or what do you mean by that, and how does that influence your work?
You know, I my work is without political advocacy or political. I'm trying to speak to as many people as possible. I happen to have born into a family of Democrats.
For our viewers who are not familiar with what a yellow dog
Democrat is? A yellow dog Democrat is sort of a Democrat for life, and that was just the expression that you had. I would have voted for Abraham Lincoln. Who knows if it had been the 1860s that I would have been a yellow dog Republican in that regard. But that just is the circumstances of my birth. My job is to tell a good story, to tell it well and tell it fairly. And so the films are attracting everybody. You know, there's some people who are into political advocacy that don't make a single convert. They preach to the converted, they preach to the choir, and that's what it is. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing. I want to reach as many people as possible, and I do on both sides of the proverbial aisle. And my politics are in some ways irrelevant, other than the fact that I'm sure it influences responses as I do it, but we work awfully hard and work with people of different political persuasions to just tell films that are general and to share. I mean, we have lost this ability to have a civil discourse, and history is still a table around which we can agree to have that civil conversation. I don't know anybody that doesn't like Abraham Lincoln and isn't drawn to his notion
of the
better
some of my friends
of our nature.
Yes. You know, arguably more than anybody over the past generation or two, you've revitalized documentary filmmaking, documentary storytelling, taking a rich interest in history and really going mainstream with it. What explains your success and appeal? Is it that you seek to go beyond kind of using history to beat people over the head?
Or? Well, I think sometimes history is used as a kind of propaganda tool or a superficial sanitized Madison Avenue celebration of, you know, the goodness of America and the good old days, and I'm clearly not interested in that. I would suggest that documentaries have been undergoing a renaissance for many, many decades, and they manifest in so many different ways. To make one or two or three people responsible is not the case. We've just been laboring in one area in which we saw that the telling of history need not be castor oil. It didn't have to be the dry recitation of dates, facts, and events, stuff you should know. The last time I checked, that was homework, but rather realizing that the word history is mostly made up of the word story, and to tell complicated and dramatic stories that that obey the same laws as stories told anywhere. Feature films are governed by the same laws, and we've done that, and people have responded by the tens of millions, and that's thrilling.
Who are your primary influences as a filmmaker and as a historian?
Well, I'm not a historian. I'm an amateur historian. The last time I took a course in American history was in 11th grade, you know, where they hold a gun to your head and make you take it. I'm a filmmaker, and my influences are why. There are still photographers, social documentary still photographers, like my mentor Jerome Liebling and Paul Strand and Walker Evans and Henri Cartier-Bresson and Dorothea Lange. There are filmmakers of the pantheon of great world filmmakers in drama, the Scorseses in America, the Orson Welles in America, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Alfred Hitchcock, John Ford, Frank Capra. But there are also other documentary filmmakers. I may not have that stylistic similarity with an Errol Morris, but you can't help but admire the genius of his stylism. And, I like Werner Herzog, who is not only a friend, but I think a passionate, almost ecstatic filmmaker that has these operatic takes on the world. And I always enjoy, though I don't work in that same way.
Where did your kind of aesthetic sensibility come from? Because it's remained, recognizable over time.
Well, a style is essentially the authentic application of technique. Every person who's an artist, has a style. And if you just change for the sake of change, you're probably not an artist, you're somebody following the fashions of the time. So if you go into a room of Cézanne paintings, they all look like, from the middle, the same. You go up to each one and they're different. So that you recognize a stylistic similarity in my films, but only because it's me trying to express myself. But each film has its own unique and diverse sets of criteria. I grew up with a father who was an anthropologist and an amateur still photographer. My first memory is that great alchemy of watching a photograph come to life in a dark room. My teachers at school were not only filmmakers, but social documentary still photographers. I'm rooted in that thing. But I'm also rooted in writing and a kind of humanist tradition of American history that includes not just the old top-down version, but a bottom-up version that acknowledges women and labor and minorities and other people, so-called ordinary people, in the rush of history, and that American history isn't just a sequence of presidential administrations punctuated by war. If you're willing to embrace a much wider and more diverse history, then it's more complicated. And if it's more complicated, then you have to lift up the rug of history and show warts. You have to have undertow and be able to tolerate that undertow and the contradictions that attend anyone, great or so-called ordinary. And I think that's been the work for the last 35 years.
To go back to PBS, should PBS be taxpayer funded? Your
absolutely.
Current
project, it's just no.
Well, let me ask. Your current project, it's underwritten by PBS or Corporation for Public Broadcasting, some nonprofit foundations, as well as the Bank of America. You could get funding for your projects, right?
That's not true. Upwards of 40% of my project come from some governmental source or another. PBS is not exactly governmental.
Right.
It is actually not governmental, but it gets some money from the government, and they give us money, usually the
world,
subscription stuff. But the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is a significant funder, and quite often the National Endowment for the Humanities are. In a perfect world, we'd want government support and a lot more of it that would exist.
Now, why though? Would
because the marketplace can't take care of everything. It's subject to the whims and the caprices of sponsors who want to change things. When you wake up at 3 a.m. and your house is on fire, you don't call the marketplace. You are not expecting the marketplace to protect you after 9/11. And while I don't mean to suggest that public television has anything to do, let me finish, with the defense of this country, it helps make the country worth defending because it has a set of people operating free of those pressures of the marketplace, and it just so happens that they produce some of the best children's, some of the best science, some of the best nature, some of the best arts, some of the best public performance, some of the best public affairs, and some, I'm told, some of the best history on the dial. That's not so bad with one foot in the marketplace and the other tentatively out. And I have dedicated myself not just to working there where I have creative freedom and free of commercial interruptions, but because I believe in the idea of service and the exchange. Television is a passive medium that washes over us and puts us to sleep, and this offers us the opportunity. When people looked at our National Park film, 10 million of them got up off the couch and went to visit a national park.
But what I'm saying, though, is it's not a question of whether or not you can get money from the government and do good things with it, but is that the best way to fund?
Because I am probably the best known independent producer in public television, or let's just say one of the best known.
Yeah.
We are in the most difficult economic circumstances, and I've gone from fundraising 25% of my time to 75% of the time. I could run for Congress now,
but the
government stuff is held firm. If I lost that, I would be out of business.
But I mean, is that a problem for taxpayers to solve?
Not at all.
Yeah, but I mean, that it is.
For taxpayers to solve, we are the only developed and industrialized country that spends almost zero on arts and humanities, if you can include that.
But, from the government, because in terms of actual philanthropic giving, we give tens of billions of dollars a year.
So I looked to offset that.
Let me ask this. The marketplace or funders in nonprofits or from the marketplace put strings on creative control or on the projects they fund, but there's no similar, your projects get funded solely on the merits?
Yes.
As opposed to from the nonprofits that might also fund your work.
What
I'm saying is that
I have a patchwork quilt of funders, and none of them exert any influence,
including
on content.
Private businesses.
Exactly.
Right. So can't.
But that's the nature of public television, not the nature of private businesses. If I had a funder that was from the marketplace,
if they were funding your movie fully, they would exert pressure. because it's a hodgepodge.
They could fund me fully in public television, and they could exert no pressure. In other
instances, or in private television, right? Because Errol Morris does not seem to labor under either a great need for public funding or a lot of corporate control.
But he also works a great deal of his time doing commercial work on the side, which I don't have the time or the luxury or the talent.
I mean, I'm not questioning this. It's an interesting topic.
It's a great debate, I've spent 30 years realizing how lucky I am because there is public broadcasting. It is incredibly difficult. I could easily, if I jumped to some other market, fully marketplace, enjoy many picture deals, but they would own it, they could control it. Mm-hmm. The real proof of it is to watch the arc of my professional life and see that at every time, without naming names, groups came to me and said, what are you working on? Or I would go to the groups and I say, I'm doing 11 and a half hours of still photographs on the Civil War, and they laughed me out of their office. Right. Then when it was the highest rated program in the history of PBS, they came to me, what are you doing next? I said, I'm doing a sequel to the Civil War. Oh, that's great. What is it? A history of baseball. Okay. How long is it? 18 and a half hours. Laughed me out of the office. When that had even higher viewership than the Civil War, they came to me, what are you doing next? I said, a history of jazz, and they said, African-American stuff doesn't sell. Yeah. So I got to do the work that I wanted to do, that inly rejoiced.
And you wouldn't be able to do that through HBO.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, because it's
no, but they would still own it. They would still control it. There would be a boss above.
But the limit of the argument, then you're saying the taxpayer is giving you free money to do things, and we don't get anything back from that in terms
of
ownership?
Indeed, I pay back my grants 100%. Okay. If McDonnell Douglas did that for the defense contracts, our budget would be a different thing. But I receive $1,349,500 from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the first money that the Civil War received went to pay that back in full.
Great.
So the people of the United States have been made whole. So what's the question? This government, as John Adams said, he said, I study war and politics so that my son might study commerce and industry, so that my grandchildren might study art and music. The whole purpose of the United States was to foster what Jefferson thought in the pursuit of happiness was not a hedonistic pursuit of things in a marketplace of objects, but a lifelong pursuit of education, which the only thing on the dial that seems to be dedicated to this, and I would ask you to go and look at what the Arts and Entertainment Network is doing, or what the Discovery Network is doing, or what the History Channel is doing,
HBO
is a wonderful oasis within that, but still with regard to control and whatever. And the History Channel, because of the addiction to commercials, can only go this deep before they have to tell you the hook that's going to keep you hopefully watching to the next one. And then the next dive is even less deep because they have to remind you where they've been and tell you where the next hook is.
Briefly by talking about, you talk about owning things and being able to, control the distribution.
You're not owning, but really having creative control.
Right. But we're also, which is, obviously every artist, every producer, every director, every writer wants that. And it's hard to maintain in the best of circumstances. We live in a world where there are proliferating outlets, where there are copyright laws, regardless of whatever their intentions or their stated policies are harder and harder to enforce. Is this a good time for cultural expression, or do you find it chaotic? Are you worried about where are the films going to come from? Where's the capital, et cetera? How are you feeling about living in a proliferating world?
I feel pretty optimistic. I think it is chaotic, and chaos causes anxiety, and you don't really know, particularly with ownership and copyright, audience. I've gone through where selling 60-millimeter prints for $900 to libraries was a viable thing. And libraries had budgets to buy several films a year. And then we went to U-matic and then to VHS, and those went down in price to DVDs, and there seemed to be a marketplace, and now it's all downloads, or getting to be all downloads. So there is a kind of anxiety about changing things, but this proliferation of equipment, the proliferation of platforms and outlets, can only be a good thing. The biggest problem is the fragmentation. That when I grew up, there were four or five channels, and people basically shared a common canon of knowledge and awareness of the world. Now people can seek their own self-satisfying sources,
it's
hugely dangerous.
How is that dangerous? Well, let's say there are four or five countries. in Europe, and people, you know, it was good to keep people there, or is it good to allow them to emigrate wherever they want?
That's the completely inappropriate analogy. Okay. What I'm saying that if you're a country of 250 right. million when I was growing up, and there were five yeah. outlets, three, you know, national nightly news, people knew more or less the same thing. Now, if you're a conservative and you get all your information from Fox, right. or you're a liberal, you get all your information from MSNBC, you are self-selecting the information you're getting. You may not be aware of the stuff that the general broadcast had. And people can then develop misconceptions. The lies can not only go around the world three or four times before the truth gets started, but you can actually labor under falsehoods, either left or right. And I bemoan
weren't
that.
Weren't the falsehoods more just as kind of widespread in a world of Walter Cronkite?
No.
And Brinkley and Huntley, and more pernicious because that there was only the official story.
No. No, not at all. And they weren't giving the official story. What they were struggling to do was adhering to concepts of balance in journalism that have basically disappeared, certainly within the cable world, in which it's advocacy. Now, there's is something very good about hearing somebody who right. is Marxist or fascist and to understand that. But what we found is that people tend to gravitate to what is self-satisfying. And that's a dangerous thing. To hear only what you want to hear is not to be exposed to the truth. For example, with the war in Vietnam, in which Walter Cronkite, who bent over backwards and his network bent over backwards with probably the most storied tradition of excellence in journalism, came to the painful realization that something was going wrong.
But then in the
and that was a startling thing for people to wake up and see.
When we consider something like the Iraq War, though, where you have mainstream outlets such as the New York Times and ABC News essentially just carrying water for the administration, it was these alternative outlets.
I wouldn't characterize it as that. I know what you're referring to, and of course, that's shameful moments when people have made
but
mistakes.
I'm saying it
mistakes
that
will
the,
always
the
be made.
The fragmentation was
but,
exactly because
I think you're trying to fit something in that doesn't quite fit. Mistakes will always be made. Humans will always be susceptible to persuasion. But when you are addicted to one particular point of view, and that's all you show, if you are absolutely certain that this person is Satan, and that's
right.
all that your thing does, and this person happens not to be Satan or
yeah.
God,
right.
and this person happens
and
not to be God, then you're actually
fair,
not letting me finish anything I'm saying. You're not letting me finish the sentence. But I'd like to complete
yeah.
that. If it is those extremes rule and dominate, then you have no chance to actually understand that the nature of human life is itself a complicated, dichotomous thing that goes back to what we were talking about, that we are both generous and greedy, that we are both Puritan and purient, that we are both sincere and hypocritical, that we both listen and we interrupt.
I am often accused of being better on the interruption side. Is that a fair depiction of, say, Fox News and MSNBC, that they demonize and that they
no,
do not
No, because
allow...
I think the superficiality of what we've just been talking about, just the just the nature of our conversation right now requires that everything gets reduced to a shorthand.
Yeah,
Fox is
that.
Never
I mean,
this one
you're
way.
Saying, I mean, you worry about fragmentation of audience partly because people seek out self-satisfying sources of information or cultural identity, and I guess I'm questioning that, or is it that they're actually seeking out something that is not self-satisfying in a negative way, but is in an expressive
Which
way?
Which is a really good question, and I travel the country and I see more of the example of the negative influence of that. I see the narrowness of viewpoints left or right. And, you know, the Latin motto of the United States is e pluribus unum, out of many one. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the late historian, used to say that we suffer today from too much pluribus and not enough unum. Mm-hmm. I'm in the business of unum, and so when you kind of go out and see the extent to which pluribus has taken over, that we no longer share experiences in common, except in the most dramatic moments, mm-hmm. like 9/11 really brings all of a sudden, MSNBC and Fox are indistinguishable, that's actually a positive and good moment, and it shows that people kind of yearn for a sense of community and connection, despite the fact that the proliferation of all these sources does offer this cornucopia of options, which are terrific. One of the negative aspects, and they're always that, every knife has another edge to it, are these sort of pernicious you know, distractions into, in the case of a political discussion, going in. But one can't label it all bad or all good with the MSNBC Fox model. They're complicated dynamics within themselves as well. And that's what the, it's so limiting for us to sort of dispense with them with the label of left or right, because it is much more dynamic. That's why I find staying something that tries to see a broader view, that understands distinct, distinct perspectives, helps you in the long run.
And I guess to bring it back to prohibition, I mean, this is one of the things that your series does, is that it complicates the idea that prohibition was all going one way or the other.
And that's right. Or that, as you pointed out, there were all these various factions, left and right, you know, black and white, that were for it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we woke up to that in the middle of it. It was too easy to dismiss this as purely a retrograde conservative attempt to pull the country back to some good old days that had never existed. It was a much more complicated dynamic, a genuine concern for the toll of alcohol, an ability on the part of the United States to always think, not naive, not just naively, it was naive, but also sincerely, that you could correct the ills of society through legislation, and that appealed to a broad number of people, sometimes with nefarious things. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan wanted it because the worst thing in the world was to see a black man with not just the ballot, but now a bottle, and that would turn them into beasts, and it represented the worst kind of racism. But on the other hand, Booker T. Washington wanted it because he thought alcoholism distracted from black advancement. And so what do you do with that other than to look at it as phenomena and kind of an equal weight and go forward and try to understand the crazy insanity that prohibition was?
Final question. Do you have a next project lined
up? Oh, I've got 7 films in various
Any
stages.
Any that you want to share with
oh,
us?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't understand why filmmakers always say, well, I can't really talk about this project. We've just finished editing a film on the history of the Dust Bowl. We're completing a film in editing on the Central Park jogger case. Mm-hmm. Those 5 black and Hispanic boys accused of wilding served their full sentences, didn't do it.
That's right.
We have a major series on the history of the Roosevelts. We're shooting right now a film on Jackie Robinson. We're shooting right now a major series on Vietnam. We're in research and pre-production on a series on the history of country music. And we're designing a biography on Ernest Hemingway, which will take us through this decade.
Great.
Well, God and funding willing.
I'm not sure I believe in either of those, but more power to you. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with documentarian Ken Burns, whose latest project is Prohibition. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.